It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. That banana you nibble at your desk, your supper salad, a lot of the plants we eat, and our notions of healthy eating all owe their existence to one little known man, the Russian botanist Nikolay Vavilov.
He was the world's greatest plant explorer. He collected more seeds and tubers and fruits from around the world than any person in human history. And he started out collecting seeds in about 1916 and worked up until his arrest in the early 1940s and imprisonment by Stalin.
That was ethnobotanist Gary Nabhan. Lots happening here today. We have the creator of Netflix Chef's Table and Chicken Every Which Way with Britain's Diana Henry. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Some stories remind us of the extraordinary things that one person can accomplish, and they bear repeating. Gary Nabhan, the ethnobotanist, brought us this kind of story a while ago. And looking back on our 20 years on air, it still stands out. First, a little about Gary. He spent his life studying the land and the people who live from it. His work brought him a MacArthur Genius Fellowship. He writes a great deal about biodiversity and conservation, but he did a book about a singular man who qualifies as extraordinary and who was forgotten. The book is Where Our Food Comes From, retracing Nikolay Vavilov's quest to end famine. Gary, it's good to have you back with us.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, Lynn.
So Gary, what made Vavilov so famous?
He was the world's greatest plant explorer. He collected more seeds and tubers and fruits from around the world than any person in human history. And he started out collecting seeds in about 1916 and worked up until his arrest in the early 1940s and imprisonment by Stalin.
Could you tell us that story?
Well, Vavilov was collecting seeds in the borderlands of Russia and Eastern Europe when he was apprehended. And he disappeared in front of his staff. A car came up with KGB agents in it, took him away. And as World War II rolled up and into Russia, no one knew where he was. It ends up that he had been imprisoned just a few blocks away from where his son and his wife were staying, and they never knew that he was there.
Oh, my.
And after over a year and a half of eating frozen cabbage and moldy flour, he died of starvation. The man that taught us the most about where our food comes from and tried for over 50 years to end famine in the world died of starvation in a Soviet gulag.
And he was a very famous scientist in Russia, right? And Russia was famous for its famines that used to wipe out thousands and thousands of people.
Over the years, decades and centuries prior to Vavilov's birth, there were 120 famines triggered by drought or catastrophic weather events that killed millions and millions of people. During his lifetime, there were three famines that killed millions in Russia, and the last one was largely due not to a drought, but due to Stalin's collectivization of private farms and turning them into an assembly line production system that reduced yields in Russia because all of a sudden no farmer owned his own land and had control over his crops. And so, ironically, Stalin needed a scapegoat for this famine and the failure of his collectivization of farms, and he chose Vavilov.
Now, Vavilov traveled all over the world. You said something in the book about five continents collecting seeds and culture.
Vavilov was an incredible explorer of food diversity. He traveled to 64 countries on 5 continents collecting seeds. He learned 15 languages. And so he was one of the first scientists to really listen to farmers, traditional farmers, peasant farmers around the world, and why they felt seed diversity was important in their fields. And so all of our notions about biological diversity and needing a diversity of foods on our plate to keep us healthy sprung from his work 80 years ago. And if justice be done, he would be as famous as Darwin or Luther Burbank.
Now, his death, very tragic, but all of these seeds, from what I understand, went into a seed bank in St. Petersburg, right?
That's right. There's something in St. Petersburg, just a few blocks away from the Hermitage Art Museum, one of the great museums of the world. There is a seed bank down in the basement of a stodgy old Russian building that had not only his 220,000 seeds, but another 150,000 from other collectors. And during the siege of St. Petersburg in 1941, the staff locked themselves in that building. They didn't know where Vavilov, their leader, was, but they were so dedicated to the mission that they shared to collect and conserve the world's food diversity that they locked themselves in to protect the seeds both from the Nazis and from starving people in their own streets who wanted to find grain or potatoes of any kind and eat them. And over a series of months in 1942 and 1943, a dozen of the scientists starved to death while guarding those seeds. And one of them said, "It was hard to wake up. It was hard to get on your feet and put on your clothes in the morning. But no, it was not hard to protect the seeds once you had your wits about you, that saving those seeds for future generations and helping the world recover after war was more important than a single person's comfort."
That seed bank today, does it still exist?
I've had the blessing of visiting the seed bank in St. Petersburg, and we looked at a wall of photos of the people who died protecting those seeds, and I've never been so deeply moved by the courage of scientists in my life, that they put humankind before their own personal lives seemed to me an astonishing act.
Gary, it's an amazing story. Thank you for telling us.
Oh, I'm grateful to be here with you.
Gary Nabhan is author of Where Our Food Comes From, Retracing Nikolay Vavilov's Quest to End Famine. Well, we think it's appropriate to celebrate one of the world's oldest domesticated crops, the turnip. Take a look at Indian chef Vikas Khanna's recipe for turnips in coconut and mustard seed curry. You can find it at splendidtable.org. For all we apartment dwellers or black thumb types who yearn for fresh things snipped from our own plants, even if they're on windowsills, solutions are afoot. They come from organic farmer Elizabeth Millard. She faced long Minnesota winters hungry for fresh-picked eats. So she devised what might be a siren song for even non-gardeners. Her book is Indoor Kitchen Gardening, Turning Your Home into a Year-Round Vegetable Garden. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Lynn.
So, okay, you start the book with microgreens, so I gather that's a good starter project.
Yes.
Give me, just do a brief walkthrough of how do I begin growing microgreens and which ones should I start with?
Sure. So microgreens are basically the first stage of growth of a plant. So it's not like there's some special plant out there called microgreens. So you can have this wide variety. You could have basil, carrots, radishes, mustards, mm-hmm. and you can create a mix with different microgreens. And all you really need is just a little bit of soil because they're going to have a very shallow root system.
Right.
And drainage would be great. So a lot of times we grow microgreens in those little plastic containers that you have for blueberries.
Oh, yeah, because right. they have holes in them.
Yeah, or yes. raspberries or something
yeah,
like that.
Right.
And that's something that would fit really well on your countertop.
Because they don't need a super amount of light?
Not really. You just get a light and you put it pretty close.
How long does it take before I have a green?
It depends on what the variety is. If you have something that's longer, let's say beets, then that would take a longer amount of time, maybe 3 or 4 weeks. But if you have something that's fast, like cress, maybe a week.
And that's it. I've got it.
That's it. You have it.
You said something here that I thought was really intriguing. It sort of stopped me in my tracks. That there's 40 times in some cases nutrients in a microgreen than in the mature plant. Did I get that right?
Yes. I have been doing some research on that. And this was an academic study from the Journal of Agricultural Chemistry, I believe. I might have that. You'll have to buy my book to find out if I'm correct. But they did a nutrient density study, and they found that because the energy of the plant is so concentrated that it's incredibly nutrient dense.
And they're very powerful in terms of flavor.
Yes, extremely.
Really distinctive.
Really intense.
Okay, from microgreens, the next place that you go is the sprout.
Yes.
Now, I always think of, you know, bean sprouts, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you talked about something that really rang a bell with me. And I'll tell you a quick story. We were doing a show in Hawaii several years ago, and we were on a farm where a man was working organically. And I was asking him, you know, what are you doing that's different from everyone else? And he said, well, we're trying to do corn shoots. And he took us to a small building because he said, we try to keep it out of the light. And you walk in, it's pitch black. And the aroma of sweet corn was so intense. It was like a wave coming at you. And there were these 3-inch high yellow shoots.
Mm-hmm.
I was just blown away. Can I do that?
Yes.
Really?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, if you want to have a whole warehouse full of them, that's up to you.
Well,
but yeah, we, my partner Carl and I just decided for fun to see if we could grow these sweet corn shoots. So we just bought some organic popcorn from the co-op and we soaked them in water so they would begin to sprout a little bit.
Right.
And then we just threw them into some soil. And the reason that
they don't cover anything.
Oh, no, you don't have to.
You do it on top of the soil.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So you do it on top of the soil, microgreens too, and
right.
any kind of shoot you do. And they're so weird and flavorful, and they taste like you're biting into sweet corn, into fresh sweet corn, not even cooked sweet corn.
Oh,
it's amazing.
I can only imagine putting this on a salad or just putting this in my mouth. Has got to be just great. Now, okay, so the sprout idea is basically you soak whatever you want to sprout and then it goes on a thin layer of soil?
Right, exactly.
And generally it'll take, what, a week or so to sprout depending on what it is?
Yeah, it depends on what it is. The peas really don't take very long at all. We do a lot with the pea shoots, so that might take just a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 2 or 3 days.
Boy, this is instant gratification.
It really is.
I like that. I like that a lot. you talk about lemongrass, and this was very striking to me. Lemongrass I love. It's a wonderful
mm-hmm.
seasoning. We're seeing it more and more. But it's hard to find. And when you find it, it's often $12, $13 a pound.
Right. And it looks a little worse for wear because
yeah.
it's had
yeah.
a long journey.
And it's a long, tall stalk. Mm-hmm. I can sprout this in my house.
Yeah.
How do I
do
it?
Well, if you can get it from whatever source, you need to have a source for the lemongrass.
Right.
And then a little bit like an onion where you just put it in some water and it should begin to sprout and have some roots.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, you can just plant it.
We can do that with onions?
We do that with scallions all the time. So, I mean, I think at this point we buy scallions on the off season, maybe once every month or so. And we use a lot yeah. of scallions. So just be sure to buy the ones that still have the roots on them, the little white
yes, yeah,
little roots.
Yeah.
And you put those in water. And then what it will do is grow from the top. And then you cut those and it will just keep on trucking.
It'll keep doing it. And
it'll
you just keep cutting.
It's a happy little plant. It wants to please you.
I would imagine with all the shallow planting you're talking about with sprouts and microgreens,
mm-hmm.
I would imagine that mold or you know, that kind, if you overwater, you're really going to have a deterioration problem. I mean.
Right. And that's why also in the book, one thing that I like to say is about airflow. So you really want to get maybe one or two small fans. If you have an overhead fan, that's perfect. Just set it on low.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're doing inside is you're trying to replicate the outside as much as possible. So when you think about outside, there's wind.
Right.
And that stresses the plant just a little bit. And that's good. The plants need just a tiny bit of stress.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Elizabeth Millard is the author of Indoor Kitchen Gardening. Coming up, the creator of Netflix series Chef's Table and Chicken Recipes Unleashed by Britain's inimitable cook, Diana Henry. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Are elite chefs craftsmen or artists? It's a debate that continues, and one that David Gelb added to with his film about a Japanese sushi master, Jiro Dreams of Sushi. Well, he's still looking at that question with his new documentary series on Netflix called Chef's Table. His camera lovingly follows six chefs from five countries, probing not just what they cook, but also their lives and their loves, the essence of who they are. Our contributor Francis Lam spoke to David about the series.
Hi, David. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's awesome to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Chef's Table, this is a beautiful show. And the food looks gorgeous, of course, but really the stories are so rich. But as I was watching, I kept thinking, okay, is this a show about chefs? Or really, is it a show about drive? Or is it a show about creativity? Or is it a show about sacrifice? So, what to you is this show about?
I think it's about all of those things, and it's very much a character-driven series where each episode is about a character who is obsessed. They're all completely obsessed with what they do. And so, you know, there are artists in all different types of fields that do this, so it certainly isn't exclusive to being a chef, but to be a chef and to be a great chef, you must be obsessed. It's one of the hardest professions. I mean, to own a restaurant and to be a chef, which is, you know, each of our chefs, well, most of them are owners of the restaurant as well. And, you know, you're running a business that has to perform on point every single evening. And, you know, as a filmmaker, I get to make something once and then you can just play it and it's the same every time you play it. But for a chef, it's a lot more like performing on a stage in a way, because every single night you have to be at that level of excellence. Because you never know when the food critic is going to come or when the journalists are going to be there. And one off night can be a catastrophe. And so I'm just so kind of impressed by the drive of these chefs. People who have been telling them no, it's impossible, their entire lives. And they all have kind of fought through that. And I just think it's incredibly inspiring.
Hmm. And how did you select the chefs that you wanted to profile?
Well, we're looking for people who have kind of forged their own pathway and kind of created their own version of their cuisine. So, for example, Massimo Bottura, who is now on the San Pellegrino 50 best list, the number three restaurant in the world is Restaurant Osteria Francescana, and he has three Michelin stars and is world renowned. But when he started, he was considered to be a bit of a food heretic in Italy. Especially in Modena, where he's from, there's a very strong gastronomic tradition there. And, you know, you're really not supposed to mess with grandma's recipes. That's what they all say. And he was determined to kind of reinvent that cuisine. And that's very similar to what Nikki Nakayama does in Los Angeles with her version of kaiseki. And it's very similar to what Francis Mallmann does. You know, he works always with fire and outdoor environments and making that his own. And so we're really looking for chefs who are defying the conventions and being really brave. And that kind of courage is something that we're really looking for in our characters. Courage, relentlessness, and kind of a purity of vision that they refuse to compromise.
Hmm. You absolutely, that comes through so much when you watch these films. But when you bring up Massimo, I also think of Lara. Mm-hmm. Lara is his wife and in many ways has been sort of his creative collaborator. But she has this really striking moment where she says, I forget the quote exactly, but she says, you know, when I married Massimo, I married his restaurant. And the chef's personal vision makes everyone else around the chef have to make personal sacrifices of their own, right? Mm. So that's a really interesting tension. As a filmmaker, are you drawn to that tension as part of the character? Like, does that undermine the story you're trying to tell?
Oh, not at all. And, you know, I think that one of the themes that we consistently explore is the cost of greatness or the cost of, you know, wanting to be great. And there's always a cost. And it's something that's very interesting to me as a filmmaker because – and I think it's interesting to anyone that, you know, has a creative job because, you know, there is an urge to just stay in the office and not come home at night because you have this kind of relentless desire to be the best and you just have this drive. You just don't want to leave it. Like I don't – I have trouble leaving the editing room just as many of these chefs have trouble leaving the kitchen. And we love to explore that because – at its heart, this show isn't so much about what they're cooking or what their technique is, but it's really about the why. And we're trying to figure out, you know, where does the drive come from and why do they do it? And in many cases, they're doing it for their family. This is the great kind of contradiction. You know, they're doing it for their family, but at the same time, it removes them from their family in certain ways.
Yeah. And what draws you, I mean, obviously the stories are really intense, but what draws you to making movies about food as well as the chefs? Is there something about capturing the food scenes that is really interesting or inspiring to you?
Well, I love to eat. And, you know, that comes from my parents. My mom, Donna Gelb, is a recipe chef, and she's worked on two of the books of Frances Mullman, who's featured in our series. And, you know, she was very much an inspiration for me. She always, you know, we would always eat well. And when my parents used to be together, we would travel and my mom would always take me to the, you know, the best restaurants, even though I was a little kid. And she's always been kind of testing recipes at home for various magazines or cookbooks. And so I think that this kind of love for food comes from, you know, just from my childhood. And shooting the food scenes is always a lot of fun, you know, because the plate itself is already a work of art. And then we're trying to find the best way to capture the essence of that. And then the crew gets to kind of dig in because we wouldn't want to let the plate go to waste. So that's one of the most fun parts of the shoot. And the crew loves that part.
Yeah. And these food scenes are so like melodic and so beautiful. And they're set to the music as well. But when you shoot them, are they choreographed or are they just documented? How do you actually capture them?
Well, you know, in Jiro Dreams of Sushi, there's a scene that we refer to as the Sushi Concerto. And that's the scene where Yamamoto-san, who serves as a narrator of sorts for the film, walks you through what Jiro-san's omakase course is like. And he, you know, he kind of describes it as a symphony, you know, with three acts to it, which I thought was kind of a beautiful description. And we kind of have carried that over where, you know, in each of our shoots, we would have what we called a food symphony, where we would the kitchen would essentially work for us for a little bit before service would start. And yeah, we would set up, you know, our lighting to make sure the food would look beautiful. And we have kind of a robotic camera that can do very specific choreographed camera moves. And it's a lot of fun to shoot them because it's really, it's like, you know, how do I draw the audience's eye into what I'm seeing when I'm sitting here and eating this? You know, before we do a shoot, we always have a meal at the restaurant so we can kind of experience the food. And then we think about ways that we can kind of transport the audience's perspective into what we have just experienced. So we're always kind of just trying to share what we're discovering while we're shooting.
Oh, that's fascinating. All right, well, thank you so much for talking with us today, David.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
David Gelb is the creator of the Netflix series Chef's Table. Frances Lam is an editor-at-large at Clarkson Potter. And Frances is also the host of a new video series we're launching, The Splendid Table Cooks with Frances Lam. In this series, Frances, who is a culinary school survivor, by the way, shows us some of his favorite recipes and tricks and takes on some of the more elemental issues around life in the kitchen. Well, this week, it's a sauce that he's rarely without, ginger scallion sauce. Take a look. It's at splendidtable.org. Some people are born to be food writers. Take Diana Henry. She was working in TV as a producer when she started keeping a notebook in her handbag with lists of meals and ingredients to help her think of dishes on the way home. There were pasta dishes, easy ways with pork and salmon, but the longest list, by far, about 8 pages worth, was about chicken. Well, she's finally written that chicken book. It's called A Bird in the Hand, her 9th book, by the way. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, met up with Diana in the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C.
Diana, nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So what's up with you and chicken?
I've just always loved it, and my family love it, and I was brought up to like it and to use every bit of it, the bones as well as the flesh. My grandfather was a farmer of dairy, beef, and poultry, so I grew up not regarding chicken as just kind of, oh, it's just, you know, the boring meat. It was something that was celebrated in my family.
Well, you have that funny story about chicken Maryland, which I've never even heard of.
I know,
what is
I can't believe it. I've come to the States and nobody knows what chicken Maryland is, and it's what we grew up with. If you went out for supper in the 1970s, which is when I was kind of growing up in Ireland, nearly every menu would have, in a grill room, they would have chicken Maryland on the menu. And that was, it's a kind of quarter chicken wrapped up in bacon and then roasted. And that was served, this sounds awful, but honestly, it was delicious. It was served with a fried banana and corn cakes.
I don't even know where, I mean, it sounds like something Elvis Presley would have been serving.
It's delicious, Sally, but I don't, clearly it did not come from Maryland.
No, I don't think it did. All right, so I'm going to cut straight to the chase here and just say, SOS, give me a couple ideas of new things to do with chicken.
Okay, probably my favorite and the quickest supper dish in the book is Turkish spice chicken thighs with a hot green relish. And basically, you just marinate the chicken thighs in olive oil, cinnamon, cayenne, crushed garlic, bit of cumin, stick it in the fridge and leave it for, I mean, half an hour is fine, longer if you want to. And then while that's happening, you're just going to cut up about a third of a cup of green olives that are pitted, crushed garlic, a red chili and a green chili, take the seeds out, a big handful of mint, an even bigger handful of cilantro, extra virgin oil, a little white balsamic vinegar because it gives it a tiny bit of sweetness, and lemon juice. And then pound those together, not so that you're completely breaking them up, but you release the flavors from the herbs. Then you basically take your chicken from the marinade, get your griddle really hot, cook it on both sides, and that is it. And if you serve that with yogurt as well, so you have hot chicken, cold yogurt, hot spiciness against the kind of freshness of the yogurt, it is knockout because it does so many things to your mouth
at
one time.
It sounds delicious and really simple. You need to gather the ingredients, but that's about it.
Yeah.
So give me another idea.
Okay, this is chicken with turmeric and cumin, and then you have it with crushed avocado. So this time you're going to have the whole thighs and you're going to roast them. That's the easiest thing I do, is ways to do thighs differently. So they should be on the bone and have their skin on them. And then another marinade. Marinade is brilliant for chicken because people say, oh, it's a bland food. I prefer to think of it as an accessible food that will take on lots of flavors.
A canvas of sorts.
Yes, a canvas. So turmeric, paprika, ground cumin again. I love that cumin. A little bit of light brown sugar. Softened butter, a big tablespoon of English mustard, so it's really quite fiery. And you basically marinate in that. Then you stick those in the oven, 375 degrees F, and those will cook for 40 minutes. That's all you need. And all you've done is marinate them and stick them in the oven. And then on the side, avocado. I love avocado, but I don't always want to make a guacamole type salsa. So I had a kind of different go at it where I'd make it, I would crush it rather than chop it, so it still had some structure. But added to that is a bit of piquancé, so a juice of one lime and some sherry vinegar. And then I stir in some creme fraiche as well, which is a little bit sour than heavy cream. Kind of mush it up, it should still have lumps in it. And that's on the side. And I do that, if I've got time, then I will do that with corn cakes. And that combination is just fantastic.
That sounds delicious.
It is good. Mm-hmm. Another easy supper. Mm-hmm.
And what do you do anything with anchovies with chicken?
Yes. People think now anchovies are best with lamb, but they're really good with chicken as well. And another quick thing that I do is, again, a mixture of thighs and drumsticks, and I brine them this time. I'm very big on kind of just marinating and shoving in the oven, but sometimes I do sometimes I do brine things. I make that much effort. So you just brine them on all sides, put them into a gratin dish or an oven-proof dish, put shallots in that you've also brined a little as well, garlic, a little bit of chili, dried chili flakes, 5 anchovies, and 3 sprigs of rosemary. So when you, after you put your chicken in the dish, you've got to heat the anchovies in your olive oil till they get to the melting stage.
Okay.
And then you pour that over the chicken. You also put in about a cupful of vermouth, some lemon zest, and you bring that up to the bubbling point, stick it in the oven. And that'll be ready in 40 minutes.
350
degrees.
Wow, that sounds delicious as well.
It is. And they're all strong flavors, mm-hmm. you'll see. So there's something kind of punchy mm-hmm. in everything.
So, Diana, what do you do for your big deal feast meals with chicken?
Well, I can tell you one where I like to go to Spain. Basically, it's a chicken cooked with smoked paprika and potato wedges with a gorgeous saffron aioli on the side. So that's a saffron garlic mayo. No matter what the occasion is, people love a big bird on a platter.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is just a nice Spanish kind of treatment. And the colour, I usually serve the aioli, I usually serve it in the mortar that I've made it in. So it kind of looks, mm-hmm. you've just done it. And it's
festive.
Lovely. And you have that fantastic color against the other things that you're serving.
Mm-hmm. Diana Henry, so nice to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Diana Henry is author of A Bird in the Hand, Chicken Recipes for Every Day and Every Mood. Well, she left us with that recipe for Turkish spiced chicken with hot green chili relish. You can find it, and you've got to try it, at splendidtable.org. We're going to be back in a minute to talk with you and mobile fermentation. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
I'm in the phone booth. It's a one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just ring it off the wall. I know he's there, but I just try to call. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone.
It's time for us to connect with you. You can get to us any way you feel like it. You can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can call 800-537-5252. Laura is calling from St. Louis. Laura, what's on your mind?
Well, Lynn, I took some frozen chicken leg quarters, and I defrosted them in a deep half pan, and then I seasoned them and I baked them and cooled them off and put the leftovers in the fridge. And the next day, I had this murky sort of chicken jello with a layer of fat on top, and I'm wondering what that is and what can I do with it?
Well, murky, it's not pretty, but oh boy, that's natural gelatin. What you have is what people, long before Knox gelatin, this is how people made jelly. And in some cultures, you would have taken those chicken legs, right? You would have put them into individual, you know, shallow bowls like a soup dish and poured their liquid over it. And you would have put them in the fridge. And then you'd scrape off all that fat and you would serve them with a side of vinegar and perhaps some marinated chopped onion and radish.
Wow.
This is very Eastern European. My husband was raised on this kind of thing, only it was done with pig's feet that had been completely deboned and completely defatted. But it's a really good, good thing. You can also do yogurt with garlic or sour cream with garlic, something that's creamy but a little acidic. But the way you eat it is scrape off all the fat. Pull the chicken out. If you want to, you can debone it and just cut it into chunks and then put it into a shallow dish. And you can sprinkle it with something like vinegar and fresh herbs and then dice up the jelly, okay, because it's going to be pure chicken. It's pure chicken and all the seasonings. It's delicious. And scatter that over it and bring a little bit of, you know, more vinegar and some sour cream or whatever to the table.
Wonderful.
Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, I think you're going to love it. Don't throw it away. It's just great. That's what happens when you make really good chicken soup. You've gotten all that goodness from the bones and the skin and whatever, and it's natural gelatin.
Enjoy. Yeah,
thank
fascinating.
You so much.
You are welcome. Take care.
Bye.
800-537-5252. And by the way, one of the tests of a really good chicken stock is that it does gel, because you've cooked it long enough and you've used the ingredients that are going to give up all that natural gelatin. So it's a great test. If you can stand a spoon in your chilled chicken stock, you would have the approval of many, many, many grandmothers. You can reach us on Facebook and Twitter. You can send us an email at splendidtable.org. Tara, who lives in Washington, D.C., received a bottle of coffee syrup as a gift. Now, she's not a coffee drinker, so she wants to know, can she use it in any other way? And can she adapt this as a marinade or a glaze for meats? Absolutely yes on all counts. First of all, that coffee syrup, add that to any chocolate dessert. Add that to chocolate frosting. Coffee and chocolate is just fabulous. Make hot chocolate and throw in a little bit of the coffee syrup. That combination is just dynamite. Now, as far as making a glaze, what you could do is combine that coffee syrup with something like ancho chilies. That's ancho chili powder. It's being sold in a lot of places now, and that's not a super hot powder. It's kind of velvety and sweet with a little bit of heat. And add to that a bit of garlic and a little bit of oil. And that is what you can start to brush over meat as you grill it, to glaze it, or as you roast it. Don't put it on in the very beginning, because the sugar in the syrup is going to make it burn. But do it toward the last minute. That ancho chili with the coffee syrup is really a great combination. The other thing that you can do with it too is that you can use it in custards or in frozen mousses. You've already got a base of that syrup. So if you fold in whipped cream and beaten egg whites and an egg yolk, etc., and bake that in the oven, you can get a lovely sort of puffy custardy cream, and it has that distinctive coffee flavor. So don't throw it out, and know that you don't have to drink it as a cup of coffee. Call us, 800-537-5252. Lisa is calling. Lisa, what do you want to know? Or what
Hi,
do you
Lynn.
Want to talk about better yet?
Hi, Lynn. I'm calling because our book group is reading the Clive James translation of Dante's Divine Comedy.
Ah.
And to celebrate, we want to have a dinner party serving only foods that would have been eaten in 14th century Italy, but we don't know what to make.
Oh, boy.
One of our members' husbands is a hunter, so we do have some access to game, venison, and quail.
All right.
But thank you so much for agreeing to help us, because we're sort of stuck.
My producer said in my ear, this is not a setup. I'm laughing because I spent a fair amount of time in writing my first book kind of living in the 14th, 15th, 16th century.
Wonderful.
Yeah, and with a lot of food. It's going to be Italian. You know this, right? It has to be anyway. It's Dante, for gosh sake.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Obviously, no foods from the New World or from the Americas. You know, like vanilla, chocolate, tomatoes, potatoes, all of that sort of thing. But the other thing is that during this period, sweet and savory was constantly mixed. And there wasn't such a thing as just a dessert course where the sweets showed up. So, for instance, one of the things that you could do is if you take – what kind of game do you think you might get your hands on?
Venison and quail.
Oh, we're home free here. Okay, first thing you're going to do is you're going to butterfly the quail, okay?
Great.
And then you're going to marinate the quail with – either if you can get your hands on Malaga wine, it's very hard to find. But if you can't, you can use port.
Okay.
Or you can use Madeira.
Okay.
Madeira. Cinnamon, clove, and a generous amount of black pepper, and olive oil.
Okay.
And that's your marinade for them. All right. And then what you're going to do when you want to serve them, this is a last minute dish. Mm-hmm. Is that you are going to quickly, very quickly, sauté them in a large, shallow skillet. Don't let them touch. You want to sear them on both sides. You've dried them, obviously. Sear them on both sides. Get them so that the breast meat, which is going to be a little, nubbin, is pink. Okay, not raw, but pink. All right. Set them aside, and then in those pan juices, you put the marinade, you put raisins, okay? And then you also put cinnamon sticks. And I'm just trying. And you put a bit of vinegar.
What kind of vinegar?
It would be a red wine vinegar. And you boil that down. You're making a very rich tasting sweet tart sauce. Okay?
Sounds lovely.
It is lovely. And when you set it out, you can decorate it with things like tiny kumquats, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And now, if you're dealing with venison, what would be great fun to be would be to make one of those wonderful fancy pies. And this would be a case where you might stew the venison however you want to stew it, but just leave out all those New World ingredients. Mm-hmm. And remember the play of sweet and savory. This is where it might be fun to use orange with the venison. Again, that sweet play against the venison. And what you might want to do, this is causing a lot of work, but way ahead of time, thin slice oranges, okay? Preferably Valencias because they don't have thick skins, and brush them with butter and sugar and slow roast them. And they're going to be sweet, and they're going to be have that tartness that you get from the ring of the orange, the skin. Mm-hmm. And then what you do is you layer your stewed venison in that pie shell, and you're going to use a springform pan. And you're going to make a pie dough that has white wine in it instead of water, all right? And a little bit of sugar, a little bit of sugar. Again, it's always that sweet. And you're going to line the springform pan with the pie dough, have a lot extra because you're going to put a top on it. And then what you do is you do a layer of little pieces of marzipan over the bottom of that crust. You put in a nice thick layer of the stew. You do the orange sections covering up the stew. You do another layer of stew, and then you do a dusting on that of crushed toasted almonds with a little bit of cinnamon, okay? And then you're going to decorate the you-know-what out of that top. You're going to cut out leaves. You're going to make little rosettes. And, of course, you're going to make little vent holes, but they can be in the center of the rosette. And you can put all kinds of fluting and whatever on it. It should look like a showpiece. And then you brush it with egg yolk and a little teeny bit of yellow food coloring, because what would normally be used would be saffron. To imitate gold gilding. You don't have to spend all that money. Just use a tiny, tiny drop of yellow food coloring in your egg yolks and brush that on, and then bake it at about 325 for maybe an hour and a half. You want it to be really golden. And then it's going to all be hot and bubbly inside, and it's going to be absolutely something no one has ever tasted.
Wow. I didn't see the marzipan coming.
Yeah, I know. It always surprises you. And listen, if you want more on this, there are books out there about Renaissance food. Ken Alba, A-L-B-A, is someone who's done some very good work. My book, Splendid Table, has a fair amount. It's where these ideas have come from. And then there, you'll find others as well. So there's a lot of material out there. It's early Renaissance, but it's out there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your help today, Lynn. And please know that you have some very ardent fans in the Valley Brook Book Club in Durham.
Thank you. Enjoy. Take care.
Call us, 800-537-5252.
Remember when food trucks were the hottest new thing? Well, that was so 2014. Meet Tara Whitsett, who has taken her food truck, in her case a converted Michigan State Police bus, to the bucolic back roads of America. And her passion? Teaching fermenting wherever she goes. Our contributor David Leet called it her fermentation national tour.
Tara, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you certainly are a woman on a mission, I would say, wouldn't you?
Yes, I'm definitely a woman on a mission.
And you call it your fermentation on wheels, and I call it your fermentation nation tour. So, can you explain?
Yes. So Fermentation on Wheels is a mobile grassroots educational project with a strong focus on accessibility, creativity, and building community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm based in Eugene, Oregon, and I live and work out of my bus. And basically, it's a way for me to reach a large number of people, all ages and socioeconomic levels, and teach the art of fermentation as well as the importance of sustainable foods.
And where did you come up with the idea of a bus and a school bus?
It came to me in a dream.
Really?
A literal dream. I had it three nights in a row, and I was very intrigued, mm-hmm. also a little terrified by it.
Right.
But I also wanted to explore that more. So what came about was simply a mission about farming, food, sustainability. I mean, the bus especially speaks to self-sufficiency mm-hmm. and living more sustainably. I have an off-grid system, so it's solar-based. I have to conserve water. There are all of these little aspects that make the bus a great challenge. So in addition to teaching fermentation, I also try to inspire people to live more sustainably.
And self-sufficiently.
Mm-hmm.
You're like the Jack Kerouac of the fermentation world.
Realize that?
Taking
Thank
to
you.
The road. And what is the reaction when people see a school bus and there you are fermenting something?
As far as people at workshops who enter the bus, they're shocked usually because I think most people assume it's not going to be as intense as an environment as it is
mm-hmm.
because I've done so much. I have a fermentation library, a fermentation lab. I'm fermenting anywhere from 40 to 50 gallons of food and beverages at a time on the bus. I have a sweet little workshop space for people to come in and sit down and you know,
That's wonderful.
Converse.
And what are some of the foods that you are fermenting at any given time?
Kimchi and sauerkraut, always. Mm-hmm. I teach a lot of kimchi, sauerkraut, fermented vegetables mm-hmm. because that is a more common ferment and one of the most approachable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a constant. I'm a wine and beer hobbyist, so I have quite a bit of that going on. I like to brew kombucha as well.
Right.
And then I have a collection of starter cultures. So starter cultures include sourdough starter, kombucha scobies. A scoby is a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast.
Okay.
Well,
thank
curious.
You for that clarification.
Yes. Water kefir grains, dairy mm-hmm. kefir grains, an array of starter cultures that I've picked up from others around the country that have really fascinating histories to go along with them. My sourdough starter collection is, I would say, pretty impressive. I have a 100-year-old from England, a 90-year-old from Alaska.
Really?
The Alaskan sourdough is fed with milk and white flour. So it has this kind of creaminess to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love using the Alaskan sourdough for pancakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a rye sourdough starter as well. It's 10 years old. And I love using the rye sourdough for baking a nice dense bread.
And do you have an oven on the bus?
I don't have an oven. I have a wood burning stove and a Dutch oven, so I can kind of jive with that.
Okay.
But I mostly do pancakes on the bus, and then I do a lot of baking when I'm staying with hosts on the road. That's kind of my gift. I try to do as much cooking when I, you know, to show my appreciation.
That's fascinating. Tara, I wish you great luck on your Fermentation Nation tour.
Thank you.
Pleasure to speak to you. Thank you.
Thanks, David. You too.
Find Tara at fermentationonwheels.com. And you can find David Leet over at Leet's Culinaria at lccooks.com. Find our recipe for Napa cabbage, carrot, and scallion kimchi on our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. See you here next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He said, "God made yeast as well as dough and loves fermentation just as dearly as he loves vegetation." Now, if you want to track down more information on anything you heard here today, just head to splendidtable.org. You can register for our newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, sign up for our monthly giveaways, and be sure to check out our latest video project. The Splendid Table Cooks with Frances Lamb. Our charming contributor, Frances, brings us his take on some of the more elemental techniques and recipes. We're rolling the videos out over the next couple of weeks, so check in often at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.